Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Bob Enyart. Welcome to the fourth program in our series, June is Grand Canyon Month at Real Science Radio. So far, we've aired and provided written lists online at rsr.org/Grand Canyon, our list of problems with the river carve the canyon, and our list of problems with the canyon's millions of years, and our list of problems with the flood carve the canyon. Today, we're going to look at the initial conditions that brought about the canyon. But first, in about 20 minutes, our producer, Jamie, will get Brian Nickel back on the line. Because we'll touch on Dr. Walt Brown's hydroplate model explaining the origin of the Grand Canyon, I'd first like to deal with the elephant in the room, as they say, regarding Dr. Walt Brown and the rather harsh condemnations against him from geologist Steve Austin and over the years from ICR, that's the Institute for Creation Research, and from Henry Morris co-author John Wickham, actually a lot of people, Russell Humphreys and geologist John Baumgartner, and even the president of CRS, Creation Research Society, Don DeYoung, and many others, including something at Ken Ham's Creation Museum, even to this very day, Answers in Genesis, all regarding the particular details that Walt Brown discovered about how the Grand Canyon formed. So extrapolating from my own experience and that of others, thousands of creationists have heard, even extraordinary men and women like Jane Albright, a creationist and engineer working for our military over in Europe, and Rob Yardley, who was the longtime treasurer for Chuck Smith and his Calvary Chapel Church, and Rob's still on the board of J. Vernon McGee's Through the Bible radio network. So Rob, me, Jane, and certainly thousands of others have heard from creation leaders that you shouldn't listen to Walt Brown, even that you shouldn't trust him. There are a couple major reasons for this. The second one involves the Grand Canyon. The first reason, though, is that Walt took one for the team. We present this in our video, RSR's Global Flood video. If you haven't seen it, it's on our YouTube channel. Just go to rsr.org and click on YouTube. When Dr. Brown worked for Henry Morris, the founder of the modern creation movement, Walt began teaching against something called the canopy theory or the vapor canopy theory, that the water for the flood came down from the atmosphere. Instead, Walt taught, it came up from below the crust, the fountains of the great deep. Well, Dr. Brown demonstrated the biblical evidence against the vapor canopy theory, because even though the rain stopped after 40 days, the waters continued to rise until the 150th day. So the water for the flood, it wasn't certainly not primarily from a vapor canopy up above the atmosphere. Also, he showed the scientific evidence against the canopy theory. His argument was so powerful that today, not a single leading creation scientist, to my knowledge, not a one any longer teaches the vapor canopy theory, and not one of the leading creation ministries any longer teaches the canopy theory, because it's just wrong. But as the first creationist to come out publicly against it, there was tremendous resentment against Walt. Once relationships are soured, it's very hard to repair them, even among Christians. So Walt took one for the team, carrying the movement to safety and away from that false teaching, all the while his own guys were shooting at him, and many still are. So the second major reason for the opposition to Dr. Brown is described on our website at rsr.org/sayings. That's where we keep our favorite BEL sayings. One goes like this: they never forgive the one they hurt. After the canopy theory fell, it was open season on Walt. Various creation leaders have spent almost 30 years spreading a falsehood that Dr. Walt Brown sued Henry Morris, that he threatened to sue ICR, that he sued geologist Steve Austin and others, based on the various versions of the false gossip, bringing a lawsuit allegedly regarding his Grand Canyon theory. Of course, if you did such a thing unbiblically, that would be disobeying Jesus Christ. So that claim is used to poison the well as an ad hominem argument to bias Christians against Walt's theory. Now, we aired a series on the flood models controversy with Jane Albright, who reached out to 33 leaders and scientists in the creation movement and recorded interviews with 16 of them, the ones who agreed to. Jane's that gal I mentioned, a professional engineer still working overseas for the U.S., and formerly she was with the U.S. Navy Nuclear Engineering Program. She's sharp. Like many of us, Jane has heard the gossip and slander against Walt from creation leaders, but unlike the rest of us, she recorded and transcribed some of it. And this is on our website at rsr.org/Albright. For example, the most famous creation geologist, John Baumgartner, actually wrote to Jane about Walt Brown threatening to sue ICR, Henry Morris's group, in the early 1990s. Then Jane corrected John, and to his credit, he admitted that, well, his information was, quote, based on secondhand sources. But John has been corrected previously on this exact point. And when we have an axe to grind against someone, it's hard to remember the positive information about them. The exculpatory information, especially as we get older, we tend to only remember the accusation and not that we have been corrected on that accusation previously. Even the president of the Creation Research Society, Dr. Don DeYoung, said to Jane, well, Jane, you may be aware that there have been lawsuits between Walt Brown and ICR. So Jane, knowing what actually transpired, she respectfully challenged Don on this, and he claimed to have documentation proving that this was true. It's something. But he declined to produce it. Jane asked, could I see it? He declined. Then she asked Dr. DeYoung if she could have him and Dr. Brown speak together with her on the phone, but he refused that also. Now, these were recent, but this goes back decades, including to when Henry Morris co-author John Wickham would urge people to stay away from Walt because of his unethical behavior. So here's what happened. In the late 1980s, Dr. Brown discovered where a huge lake once sat, larger than Lake Michigan. He named it Grand Lake. He located its elevation at 5,700 feet above sea level and identified its breach point where Grand Lake overflowed its southern boundary and then undercut Hopi Lake, and the two together catastrophically carved out the Grand Canyon. Well, Dr. Stephen Austin, whom I have always loved and otherwise greatly admired, he began using Walt's discovery without credit. People started contacting Walt, of course, but as the Bible says, he held his peace. Well, a couple of years of this, and then the accusations were coming at Walt that he was plagiarizing Dr. Austin's discovery, and Dr. Austin was the ultimate source of those accusations. So, as false accusations tend to do, things were spiraling into greater difficulties. So if I can try to detoxify that same well, I've read many of the original source documents on all this, a comprehensive report. I know the details, and I'll provide them in our written show summary for today's program at rsr.org/GC4 for this fourth program in our series. So you can read all this for yourself. Also, I know Walt very well and his wife Peggy. I've traveled with them both and with Walt to, a half dozen national parks, including Glacier and the Grand Canyon. My wife Cheryl and I have visited both of them in Phoenix. And when our kids were young, they went swimming in the Brown's backyard pool. We've prepared for and recorded lengthy radio interviews as online at rsr.org/Walt Brown, Walt-Brown. And I've talked with many people who have long-term relationships with Walt, who happens to have an astounding and highly credentialed scientific career beginning with a PhD from MIT. So, no, Walt did not threaten to sue Henry Morris or ICR or Steve Austin or anyone. Instead, he did what a Christian brother should do in such a circumstance, for the sake of the creation movement, no less. First, Walt spent a good amount of time trying to resolve this directly with Henry Morris and Steve Austin, ICR, to set the record straight on the discovery of Grand Lake, its elevation at 5,700 feet above sea level, and the breach point where the waters of the lake broke through their natural dam and eventually carved out the Grand Canyon. Well, they refused to do that. And of course, this would leave the accusation stand that Dr. Brown was plagiarizing Dr. Austin. So then Walt proposed to Henry Morris, Dr. Austin's boss, that they go to Christian binding arbitration. It was all set up. Travel plans were made, but a day or so before folks were to head to the arbitrator, ICR had just talked with their lawyer, and they informed Walt that they were not willing to go through with binding arbitration, even though that's what they had already agreed to in writing. And then, of course, unfortunately, whatever the mediator found would not be legally binding. So, with travel, the arbitrator, and everything set, in hoping to resolve the matter, Walt decided to give in to their insistence on not binding Christian arbitration, but only on mediation. So, they go to mediation. The mediator found for Walt on Walt's behalf. You can see the evidence that he used in the documentation that we're including with today's show page at RSR. Now, I'm not going to attempt to give a comprehensive description of what transpired in mediation before and after, and it's painful to read, but I'll summarize some of it. Walt asked, how could I be plagiarizing Steve when he was using the elevation I discovered, 5,700 feet, my name for the lake, Grand Lake, and the breach point? And for example, in 1988, I'm speaking as Walt Brown, I described all this on a popular radio broadcast. But Steve Austin acted as though he had discovered proof, and he presented that to Henry Morris and to Walt. And this was before the mediation. Proof that he discovered Grand Lake before Walt. And that proof was the copyright page of his published annual field guide to the Grand Canyon. That copyright, the copyright page, was 1988. And this book, this was published early in that year before Walt began to publicly discuss his discovery. So when Peggy sees this, she says to Walt, that's it. That's it. The copyright page, this is proof that Steve discovered Grand Lake before you did. And Walt couldn't believe what he saw. After a century of intense research, how could two men discover the origin of the Grand Canyon, give it the same name, and even at the same elevation and the same breach point? How does that happen? So when Walt started reading through Steve's book, he saw that there were footnotes to scientific papers published in 1989. So how could that happen? How could a text copyrighted in 1988 reference papers published in 1989? Well, it turns out that geologist Steve Austin of Mount St. Helens fame, remember his classic VHS videotape from ICR in 1989, Mount St. Helens, Explosive Evidence for a Catastrophe? Remember that video? I sure do. This is the Steve Austin who in 1989 used a backdated copyright to claim to be the discoverer of Grand Lake. Wow. So further comparing that text of his to the previous year's text, it was clear that Steve had added the Grand Lake at 5,700 feet material and that this wasn't simply a reprint of his previous year's text as he was claiming. So, with evidence like that and other evidence, the mediator found that not only was Walt not plagiarizing ICR or Steve Austin, Walt Brown was the one who discovered Grand Lake. And that means also, therefore, that he discovered the breach point for the origin of the Grand Canyon. And he ruled that Dr. Austin and ICR, they had to correct the record, even for the books that they already had in inventory that were already printed, that they had to include an errata sheet indicating that Dr. Brown discovered and named Grand Lake, along with the critical information of the elevation at 5,700 feet and the breach point where its waters broke through. So then everyone would know authoritatively that Walt didn't plagiarize Dr. Austin, but Steve then said in the mediation that it wasn't necessary to fix the existing inventory because there were so few books left in stock, they were almost sold out. And even then, Walt was exceedingly gracious. And he said, okay, Steve, if there are less than 1,000 books, oh yeah, there are very few books left. Okay, if there are less than 1,000 books left in inventory, then fine, you don't have to take that step. Well, it turns out there were more than that. So Steve Austin, he's a Christian and he's a scientist. So one would think that after this, in humility, he would comply and certainly not try to further obscure Dr. Brown's extraordinary discovery. Anyway, the mediation was over, and obviously Walt was so thankful to have this resolved. He flies back home to his wife. They thought it was over. Dr. Brown never sued. He never threatened to sue. Although, on the grounds that Jesus lays out in Matthew 18, he would have been justified to do so. Christians forget to understand what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 6 in light of the broader context and permission that Jesus gives in Matthew chapter 18. Anyway, Walt won the mediation. But then what happened was that instead of publicly giving Walt credit for discovering Grand Lake and the actual origin of the Grand Canyon, Steve Austin reneged on the agreement that was required by the mediator. That required him to include an errata sheet in the books in inventory. ICR had somewhere around 1,500 copies of Steve's book in inventory and that they were currently selling. He was supposed to include an errata sheet saying, here's a mistake. This is Walt Brown's discovery, Grand Lake, the elevation, and so on. He refused to do that. And just the documentation on that is heartbreaking. If you only read that, a single page or so of the documentation, it's heartbreaking. So no errata sheet. And the plagiarism rumors and gossip of unethical behavior persist. Also, and it's painful to say because I've interviewed Dr. Austin right here in the Real Science Radio studio, I aired his Mount St. Helens video nationally in 80 cities from Honolulu to Orlando, Florida, presenting that to at least a couple hundred thousand of our viewers on my television program. And that video includes this powerful creation and gospel message. Steve and I, we've interacted personally on occasion and even recently. So I have a love for him and especially for ICR and my dear friends there. But I think except for one instance when Steve partially complied with the mediator, he included a footnote in a future text, but even there confused the matter, that Steve found ways to mute and to get around the obvious truth that was documented right there that day in mediation. Steve found a legalistic way around the mediator's ruling, or so he thinks he did. After 3 years of referring to the lake by Walt's name for it, Grand Lake, and even a bit before the mediation, Steve thought of a way to avoid giving Walt credit by not calling it Grand Lake, but by calling it Canyonlands Lake. So, to this day, whenever he references the lake that breached to carve the Grand Canyon, he uses his other name for it, Canyonlands Lake, and that's what Ken Ham calls it. And the museum, the Creation Museum at Answers in Genesis, they call it Canyonlands Lake. And I've brought people to that great museum half a dozen times. Cheryl and I went and spent a day there with Ken Ham all day. And he's also been in the studio. In fact, we flew there to the museum with 80 folks on a chartered Frontier jet with Joe Coors of Coors Brewery and Colorado's John Bandemir of Bandemir Speedway fame. Anyway, they got Canyonlands Lake there at the museum. That's what ICR began calling it. And with Steve Austin doing this, using Canyonlands instead of Grand Lake, well, Walt and Peggy, again, were, of course, saddened. They continue to get comments from creationists who are totally confused by the whole matter, wondering who's wrong too. And so Walt contacts ICR and the mediator, and the mediator says, well, I don't have the authority of a judge. Remember, ICR's attorney said we won't do binding Christian arbitration. Why? Because it's legally binding. Well, sadly, that scheming worked. Not really, but looked like it worked. And that's helped to divide the creation movement to this day. So the mediator says there's nothing he could do to force Dr. Austin to give credit to Walt. And that was it. For some time, until someone of the stature of ICR's associate, Dr. John Wickham, told the wrong person, or really the right person, to avoid Walt Brown because of his unethical behavior. So that person went to Walt and asked, can I see all the documentation? Austin's annual field guides, the correspondence with ICR, everything. So that person of Calvary Chapel of Port Orchard in Washington is a man who years later became a close friend of Real Science Radio, Pastor Kevin Lee. And it's his report that we're including on our website with today's program. So that's where we are with prominent creationists and leaders of big creation ministries unjustly biased against Walt. With all that said, hopefully we've detoxified the well enough that you can give a fair hearing to Walt's explanation for not only the origin of the Grand Canyon, but also for the watery foundations of the Great Deep that broke forth in the global flood called the Hydroplate Theory. So for our fourth Grand Canyon program, we welcome Brian Nickel back to Real Science Radio.
Thank you, Bob. It really is a shame that the creation movement has tried to bury these truths and in the process confuse so many. I think the power of Walt's theory really rests in the simple fact that it's rooted in known mechanics and physical processes. And it is what has led me to make these videos, and it's just terrible that he's not recognized for his achievements.
Yeah, it is sad. And, you know, there's another widespread criticism of Walt. Maybe this is the third big one. And it's even on some of the big creation websites that Walt won't peer review his work. Of course, some of his work has been peer reviewed. But besides that, it's these big creation organizations that publish the creation science journals. And they have such a harsh bias against Dr. Brown for decades. And they're the same ones saying that Walt Brown won't give us his work so we could review it. It's very difficult, the situation that's developed. So now, Brian, the initial conditions that brought about the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, so far we've brought up many issues and questions and mysteries that other theories present. But these next two programs are where the power of Walt's hydroplate theory is revealed, because it not only explains the Grand Canyon itself, but it explains how so many pre-canyon features like the layers and the geological unconformities and even the Colorado Plateau itself came to be. And hydroplate theory explains why we see what we see literally encased in the canyon walls. It also explains the surroundings on the Colorado Plateau for hundreds of miles in all directions and how those features came to be. Wow. So hydroplate theory does all of this in a very logical, linked manner that is grounded in real physics and known mechanics. So hydroplate theory answers the many mysteries and problems we've been highlighting for both older theories and other flood-based theories.
All right, so the initial conditions, if we could start off, there's a list here you've put together, about a half a dozen initial conditions. So if we could mention what they are and then talk about them in some detail. The first one is the strata, that characteristic flat gap, parallel, and often rather pure rock layers. That's to begin with. That was all there.
That's right. How did that stuff come to be? Another thing is even just the surrounding mountains on the Colorado Plateau and around the Colorado Plateau. Where did those mountains come from?
They're the Colorado Rockies, right?
Yeah.
Then there's something called the Great Unconformity we need to describe, because that was there before the canyon was formed, right? The Great Unconformity?
Yes, that is exactly right. And the unconformity has a very simple explanation, but it is not at all what we've been taught to believe.
For those who haven't heard that term, there's this dramatic difference in the strata below versus above the unconformity. So we'll talk about that. Then there's, you mentioned it already, Brian, but the Colorado Plateau, that thing is massive. So that was there before the Grand Canyon was carved, right?
Yes, exactly right. It's the Colorado Plateau is more than 100,000 square miles in area, and it's risen thousands of feet into the air.
Wow. So we got to explain how that came to be. Also, these two ancient Great Lakes named Hopi and Grand Lake, we're going to describe those lakes because this is, again, the initial conditions before the Grand Canyon was carved.
Right. To understand the problem, we need to understand each of these conditions because they all play into how things happened and why we see what we see today. Next, we have water-saturated sedimentary layers beneath and around those lakes, and we need to describe those because those, again, will describe and tell us why we don't see some features that some may expect.
Okay, water-saturated sediments. And then the Kaibab Plateau, that did not exist. Before the Grand Canyon was carved, the Colorado Plateau had lifted up, but there was, as of yet, no Kaibab Plateau. So let's start talking through these. The first one was the strata. Let's talk about why it looks the way it does as revealed in the Grand Canyon.
Right. So we've highlighted some of this already, but the strata layers are generally very flat and horizontal, and they do not show a lot of signs of erosion between each layer. We have very thick layers. We have other layers that are paper thin. And each of these layers, though, are said to have been laid down very slowly in slow processes, and they were, during that time, had to have been exposed to those same processes that would produce erosion, and yet somehow we don't see the erosion like we see today happening at layers on the surface. And so that's what we're faced with.
So how could you?
Very parallel layers.
Yeah, how could you get that those flat gaps, those paraconformities? And because you find land animal fossils and then marine fossils and land animal and marine, the standard canonical story is that an inland sea submerged the area and then retreated, and it was dry land. And then that happened again. Another sea comes and then retreats, dry land. Then another sea comes, retreats, dry land. Eight times this happens. I mean, it's evidence that the story is getting way more complicated than they originally thought it would be. But
yes, and it's very tailored. It's very tailored because each time the sea comes in, it brings uniquely new sediments for millions of years. Then those go away. And then another next sea, it has a whole different type of sediment for millions of years, if we're to believe that story.
Yeah, and the strata, the sediments tend to be very pure. Like when you're doing the red wall limestone, except for a little bit of gravel at the bottom, you got pretty pure limestone. Then you get sandstone, and it's pretty pure. And then, and so on, all the way up through all these layers, really hundreds of layers, if not a thousand or more, but 40 major rock group layers. So let's say it was all laid down by a flood. Wouldn't you still expect that the layers would be totally irregular and not so evenly and parallel distributed like the way we see in the Grand Canyon? What makes their boundaries so parallel?
So as hydroplate theory explains, liquefaction was the key to understanding why we have these very pure, parallel, flat layers laid down one on top of the other. And really, even the term laying down isn't quite proper, because what liquefaction does is it sorts material all at the same time. And what liquefaction is when any kind of soil, any group of objects really, it doesn't have to be soil, are allowed to drop through water, they will sort according to their weight, their density, and even their shape. And this is really why layers end up where they end up. It doesn't have to do with time and sequential layering being laid down.
So this liquefaction, this is a term that a lot of people in the general public have never heard. And those who have heard about liquefaction, they tend to think of it operating on a small scale, like maybe during an earthquake when there's water in the soil and a building will start to sink sideways, an apartment building. And so you can see.
Or even standing on the seashore when waves come in over your feet and you start out standing on top of the sand, but after a few wave cycles, you find that your feet are buried. You are being sorted through the process of liquefaction.
Liquefaction. If it went on long enough, you might end up totally under the sand. So
yeah, until your body reached buoyancy.
So then during the global flood, we had liquefaction happening, but only at an extraordinary scale that had never before or since been seen, because as the sediments are being deposited, these are water deposited sediments, and the floodwaters continue to go across the face of the earth. So you have basically tidal waves without the continents to stop them. So tidal waves are circling the earth, and these waves are pressing enormous amounts of water into the sediments when the wave peak comes over. And when the trough comes over, then that water is being pulled out of the sediments. So the grains of sand, the calcium carbonate, the dolomite, all these materials, once they're deposited in the floodwaters, they're then being sorted after they were buried. This is something that a lot of creationists don't think through, that liquefaction was sorting everything from fossils to minerals after they were originally deposited, and this continued for many months through the flood year. So that's why we have all these incredibly well-defined sediments with very flat boundaries between them, flat gaps that show virtually no erosion, because they were sorted into place.
That is correct. There were several mechanisms that drove several forms of liquefaction during the flood. And those are all highlighted on my videos online so that people can see each of those processes and understand how they form the layers that we see.
And even, for example, the crust is fluttering as the water from 60 miles below the surface is coming up through the cracks in the Earth's surface. The crust is fluttering. And all that vibration in water-saturated sediments is causing things to sort out.
Yeah, what the fluttering was doing was creating pressure differentials in the water and in the layers such that every time you had a cycle event, there was essentially the equivalent of particles falling through water, and that process, by definition, will sort those particles. The other you mentioned was the moon. That moon tide was also creating a pressure differential in the sediments and in the water, mm-hmm. and so that, too, contributed and caused liquefaction at the surface every single time the moon went around.
And when you wonder, why are the layers then so pure, so many of them? They are so pure because they're being sorted to their specific gravity, their density. And so today, when we look at this, and even other creationists who don't study the effects of liquefaction, which become obvious when you understand the hydroplate theory, even creationists have a hard time explaining these flat gaps and these extremely pure layers.
Right. And also how the layers got spread out over such wide areas is very difficult for even other flood theories to explain, but hydroplate theory and its understanding of liquefaction shows that they formed in place. Mm. They didn't have to be spread out by giant imagined waves. They were spread out, or they were formed in place by the process of liquefaction.
I've had great conversations with a geologist at ICR down in Dallas, Tim Clary, and I've urged him, even though we disagree strongly on the hydroplate theory, Brian, I've urged him, as he's trying to understand these layers, and he's one of the world's leading experts on the strata of the globe, I've said, Tim, would you keep liquefaction in mind when you're trying to understand how the strata came to look the way they are? And, you know, we're friends, and he did promise. He said, Bob, okay, liquefaction, it's on my mind.
Well, hey, that's a step.
Yeah. So to stress it one more time, sorting was going on after burial. This is something that not only geologists, but many creationists don't realize, that there was sorting of both fossils and sediments after they were laid down by the floodwaters. So after they were being covered up by sediments above them, the sorting continued for months. And that helps to explain not only the strata and the boundaries between them, but also it will give us insight into the positioning of the fossils that are buried in the rock layers. So can we now go to the mountain? So we talked about the layers with the flat gaps, the paraconformities, no erosion between and all these parallel strata, thousands of square miles. It's huge.
Yeah, these mountains crumpled up, but by then, these layers we're talking about, a lot of them, they had already been laid down during the flood. Mm. But then about halfway through the flood, the Earth's major mountain chains were formed in literally hours. And that was due to what is called the compression event, and really is a process where the plates were sliding on supercritical water that had been previously the subterranean chamber that had caused the fountains of the deep in the first place. Yeah. But anyway, these plates began to slide, and hydroplate theory explains exactly why they slide and everything, but they didn't have very much friction because they were riding on supercritical water, which acted like a gas. So it was almost like they were sliding on air.
And Brian, if some people listening are into our series on the Grand Canyon and they don't know the hydroplate theory, I can imagine how they just can't comprehend what you're talking about. How could North and South America slide away from the Atlantic and toward the Pacific? How could that happen? Well, I strongly recommend that they watch your videos, especially the overview of the hydroplate theory. We link to it from our website, rsr.org/flood, or you can see it on our show summary for today's program, or just go to YouTube and Brian Nichols' channel, which if you search for the hydroplate theory, you'll find Brian Nichol right there on YouTube.
Yep. So the compression event is basically what happens after these plates begin sliding. Eventually, they run out of this supercritical fluid that's underneath them, and they skid against the mantle, and that causes the entire structure to feel slowing down, like it's slamming on the brakes, and it runs into the mantle and crumples up. And that's why we see that, as we explained before, that North America and South America have major mountain chains on their western side of the continent, but then not nearly as significant mountains on the eastern sides or anywhere in the center of them. And that's because it's more like a car wreck. And the front end that took the impact is where we see those mountains. And so these mountains, the Rockies, were very new, and they crumpled up very high. And not only that, but that skidding action caused there to be a huge magma layer underneath. All the friction of, imagine a continent sliding against bare rock on bare rock. Imagine the heat that that would generate. Well, it melted a huge layer of material between the plate and the mantle. And these mountains built up right over the top of these chambers of magma that were relatively shallow. They weren't from imagined plumes of magma coming from the center of the earth. They were generated due to the compression of it.
Magma can't even rise up above what's called the crossover depth. A couple hundred miles below the surface, when rock melts, it gets denser and it sinks. So this plate tectonics idea that you have rising magma plumes from the Earth's outer core, that's simply not supported by the physics.
Right. That's another item that is covered in the Hydroplate Overview series, and I'd encourage anyone to go review that and look that information up.
The next item is this great unconformity. And if you see a picture of it, it's easy to see. On the radio, it's more difficult. But you know what we've learned, Brian? When people could hear and understand some scientific discovery observation just through the words, just through radio, they really do understand it. And then when they see it again in a video like your videos or in the photographs in Walt's book that we sell in the beginning, then it's cemented. Then they really understand it. So the great unconformity, when you look at the layers of the Grand Canyon, you go down about a mile deep, they're all horizontal, and then there's the final bottom horizontal layer, and below that, the layers are all at an angle. They're at this very steep angle, and they're all cut off. They're like all beveled off, and so that's called the great unconformity because they don't conform anymore. So how could there be so many layers below the bottom horizontal layer that are all now on an angle? They're all parallel to themselves, but they're all on an angle, and they're all cut off sharply. They're all beveled. The tops of them are all beveled off.
So again, hydroplate theory explains how this occurred. And again, it goes back to the sliding of the plates and the compression event. So while the mountains were being crumpled up, as we just described, another thing was happening during this crash. And if you imagine yourself in a car, if you ran into something, the front of your hood would crumple up, your bumper would crumple up, but you would also feel the force of this impact. And anybody who slammed on the brakes knows what that force is. Your head and your body move forward.
Yeah, if you don't have a seatbelt on, some people have been ejected through their windshield. You just keep going forward.
That's right. And so you're decelerating quickly, and your body is tending to stay in motion, just as Newton's laws tell us. So as this plate was sliding, all this topography starts to rise up and change from being somewhat level and flat to now being tipped. And so these layers that had been laid down during the flood, in the middle of the flood, whatever layers had been laid down, they start to get tipped as they are compressed and buckled up as the topography, the granite topography, rises up from underneath of them. And so that is the mechanism that tipped these low layers that you described in the first place. And what happened was that at some point in those layers, there was a boundary line that formed. In mechanics, you'd call it a shear line or a shear plane. And there, below that line were tipped layers that were supported by the surrounding granite topography of the continent's top below it. And so those were supported granules, supported layers. But above that shear line, there were unsupported layers that just had nothing behind them but more sediments and loose material. And
the sediments on top, the layers on top, just kept sliding. They just kept sliding forward, and they sheared off. They beveled off those layers that had been tilted.
Yeah, it was along that line that you had either below it were supported layers, or above it you had unsupported layers. And as deceleration continued to increase, eventually those unsupported layers slid, and they slid in an east to west direction because that was the direction that the hydroplate was moving and crashing and slowing. Mm. And so it just like if you were sitting in a car and you had your seatbelt on, but you had a stack of papers laying next to you in the seat, when you slam on the brakes, you are staying there because you've got your seatbelt on, just like the supported layers below. So they were tipped, but they were preserved. And then the layers above, they rolled and moved, and they slid off the basically the front seat, just like you'd expect the papers to slide in a car crash. And what happened then is in sliding, those layers began to act again like a liquid. They began to act and move like a fluid again. And so you once again had liquefaction on a massive scale at the end of the compression event, which was just literally hours. All those layers that were unsupported were reliquefied, and they sorted again. And that's why on top of these tip layers, we have a bevel line that represents the shear line that today others call an unconformity. Really, it's just the shear line. And the layers above, they sorted again according to the laws of liquefaction, and they sorted horizontally.
Now, Brian, when you mentioned, you know, we're applying Newton's laws of motion and of gravity and all, I'd like to share with the audience that you're an expert in these things. I mean, when we say, well, so-and-so is a rocket scientist, you really are a rocket scientist. I mean, you work with these laws of physics, and this is your work product. You have to be able to understand physics at an intimate level to be able to do the kind of work that you do.
Well, I guess I would say probably like a lot of people that I don't know if I call myself a rocket engineer, but I certainly work with a lot of fine rocket engineers or rocket scientists. And it is true. I mean, we do rely on these same processes every day. And I think this theory, hydroplate theory, is so well done. And it's really the mechanics that it explains that really attracted me to this theory and led me to do so much work on it and to put it out there for others to understand and be able to have access to.
Yeah, with the years that you've put into these videos and just the Grand Canyon video, as I saw the different versions as you're making drafts and working toward it, and all the input from Walt Brown and so many others, it was just such a fabulous effort. Now, if you go to the secular world and you ask them to explain the great unconformity, they really have a hard time because they say by their dating mechanisms, there's a half a billion years between the bottom horizontal layer and the very top of the tilted layers. They say there's a half a billion years between those two. And yet, just like we've seen a couple weeks ago, there's absolutely no evidence of deposition of anything in a half a billion years. Now, why would that be?
Why would that be? And why would there be not massive erosion? I mean, erosion through all those layers over 500 million years and not any significant erosion. And then right next to those layers, we have the entire evidence of what a river supposedly did in forming the Grand Canyon in just 6 million years.
Right.
And we're supposed to believe that? I don't see that.
And just in 6 million years, the river, this dinky little thread of a river, forms the Grand Canyon. And then the side canyons, which we've discussed, which are massive, they get eroded away by what? By no river drainage systems, maybe by rain. I mean, it's absurd what they demand that erosion will do in that relatively short period of time, and then 500 million years and no erosion and no deposition.
Right. Just like we discussed in a previous episode.
Yes. So that brings us then to the next item of the initial conditions before the Grand Canyon was carved out, and that's the Colorado Plateau itself. We've mentioned how enormous it is and that it rose up thousands of feet into the air. We can quote from standard geology text where they say that they're mystified. Why would 100,000 square miles of rock start to rise up thousands of feet into the air above the rock around it? What makes that happen? It's not like they have an easy answer for that. They don't.
No, it's not a simple solution. And there's really even a double-ended mystery that, amazingly, hydroplate theory explains very well. And as we just discussed how the great unconformity was produced via a shear line, well, as time went by, well after the flood, with these newly formed Rocky Mountains, all that mass needed time to settle into the mantle. And so for centuries after the flood, these newly formed mountains began settling back into the mantle. And as this happened, remember, all that magma that was formed underneath these mountains had to go somewhere. It couldn't go down. It couldn't go up. And so it went sideways along the path of least resistance.
Okay, so the mountains formed in a day, as even the Bible tells us, and we see powerful evidence for the mountains having been raised up rapidly. Then things are out of equilibrium. Now there's no homeostasis to this because you have all this mass this high up above, let's say, sea level. And so the mountain ranges of the world begin to settle back into the mantle. And as they begin to settle back down, then the magma that's below them is being pushed out. It's being pushed laterally, horizontally, below the land that's next to the mountain.
And as that happens, that land has nowhere to go but up. And so that material gets forced in underneath the continent, and the granite rises up. And in the process, the Colorado Plateau is formed as those layers are lifted thousands of feet straight up. And as the continent rose up and as the plateau rose up next to the Rockies, any trapped pre-flood water that was on top of those layers was also lifted up with the continent.
Mm. So the Colorado Plateau ends up with two ancient Great Lakes on it that we've mentioned briefly so far in the series, Grand Lake and Hopi Lake. Their basins are filled to the brim, and they are being lifted up. And as they're being lifted up, that's a tremendous amount of potential energy that is being generated because the plateau is being lifted up and these massive Great Lakes are now holding this water that much higher, thousands of feet higher even above sea level than the terrain around them.
And these lakes were massive. Grand Lake is just huge. It covers a large portion of northeast Arizona and southeast Utah. Grand Lake's water level was at around 5,700 feet in elevation by the time the Colorado Plateau had stopped lifting it, basically at the point we see today. But areas like Page, Arizona, for example, just to give you a feel of the size of this lake, Page, Arizona was covered by 1,400 feet of water in Grand Lake.
Wow.
And Grand Lake stretched over 19,500 square miles of area. It even stretched up into Colorado, where Grand Junction was under about 1,100 feet of water.
Wow. And this is just massive. Yeah. If we compare it to Lake Michigan, one of our five Great Lakes, Grand Lake has more volume than Lake Michigan.
Yeah. In fact, Grand Lake has almost double the volume of Lake Michigan.
Oh.
It also stretched into northwest New Mexico, where the town of Farmington would have been covered with 300 to 400 feet of water. Grand Lake's total volume was around 2,100 cubic miles of volume.
Wow, of water. And then we have Hopi Lake, which is another equivalent to one of our Great Lakes.
Right. Hopi Lake was smaller, but it was lifted higher than Grand Lake. The topography it rose up on ended up resting at a state of about where lake level would have been 5,950 feet in elevation. So it was about 250 feet higher up than Grand Lake.
Mm.
Hopi Lake covered 10,000 square miles of area, and it stretched across northeast Arizona mostly. And places like Winslow, Arizona, and Tuba City, Arizona, were both about 1,000 feet underwater at the time. And Holbrook, Arizona, was around 900 feet of water. And just to the east of Holbrook was the Arizona State's famous Petrified National Forest, which on average was about 500 feet underwater.
Wow.
And it's very interesting that that forest, that petrified forest, is where it is. Because after the flood, many trees were ripped up and were floating in these post-flood lake waters, which were also, of course, full of silica, which hydroplate theory explains where all those minerals were dissolved and how they got into the water in the first place.
So then in our next program, when we talk about the hydroplate theory explanation for how the canyon was formed and how all these various astounding features came to be, we'll be describing that process of the petrification of the petrified forest logs. But then, Brian, if we describe Grand Lake as the equivalent of two Lake Michigans, to stick with that, Hopi Lake then, how does it compare to our Great Lakes?
So Hopi Lake's volume was, I've calculated it, around 840 cubic miles of water, and that is about equivalent to Lake Huron.
Wow. So Lake Huron and two Lake Michigans catastrophically emptying out, causing the great denudation and then carving out the canyon beneath all that other sediment that was removed.
Yeah, we'll probably get to that next week. Combined, those two lakes equated a volume of just under 3,000 cubic miles of water that had been lifted up and was restrained. And today you can go and see the results of, wow, of those breaches.
Yeah. Then we have the water-saturated sedimentary layers that are around those lakes. So the lake shores, if you go beyond the lakes, there was a tremendous amount of the terrain that was saturated, water-saturated sedimentary layers beyond, around the lakes.
Right. For really hundreds of miles around the lakes and under the lakes, there was probably another Great Lake-sized volume of water that was trapped in amongst the sedimentary particles. Mm. So a tremendous amount of water was available. And the other thing is that not all of that material had been able to harden. Some layers had hardened, but a great deal of them had not hardened. And so it made for very quick erosion when the breach happened.
So that basically there's catastrophic draining of groundwater into the lakes as they're draining out. And that brings us then to a seventh initial condition, but this is something that wasn't there. We have the Colorado Plateau lifted up with the two Great Lakes on it, but then there was no Kaibab Plateau. Did I say that right, Brian? No Kaibab Plateau.
Correct. I think many who've tried to explain the Grand Canyon try to understand how the canyon runs up through a plateau that is raised above even the Colorado Plateau. Mm. So it's like the Colorado Plateau has this extra hump in it called the Kaibab Plateau. And many who try to explain, say, their canyon theory, trying to understand the Kaibab Plateau, assuming that it was always there, have a real problem in explaining the mechanics of how that canyon carves through the plateau.
Yeah, because a river can't run uphill, and you've got the river entering 4,000 feet below the high point of the Grand Canyon. And so the standard story is another just-so story where, as the Colorado River was cutting down, the plateau was rising up at about the same rate for a period of 6 million years, which is just bizarre.
Yeah, it's a just-so story. The other problem is if you're trying to explain the Grand Canyon, assuming the Kaibab Plateau was there right after the flood and that the flood waters directly after the flood drained through the Kaibab Plateau, you have essentially the same problem as the river cutting through the Kaibab Plateau in explaining why it took the track it took directly through the essentially the hardest part for those waters to penetrate through. And what really sets hydroplate theory apart is it explains that the Kaibab Plateau was formed under the Colorado Plateau due to, again, the block faulting and the hydraulic lifting that was happening that formed the Colorado Plateau in the first place. Mm. And only hydroplate theory has proposed and understood this mechanism that caused the Kaibab Plateau to rise.
So, Brian, now I'm really looking forward to next week. Now that the stage is set, we have the initial conditions. Now we let the hydroplate theory shine and showing how it explains so many features, not only the cutting of the canyon. So that's going to be fun. And there's one other thing I'm hoping we can do. Maybe next week we could answer the critics who say, hey, Grand Lake never existed. There's not evidence of an etched shoreline and lake sediments and so on. I'd like us to do that too. You think we could put that on our plate?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. That sounds awesome. Brian Nickel, thank you so much. All the effort you put into your video on the Grand Canyon and now into the series, it's humbling, Brian, to work with you. Thank you for allowing us to sell your video on Blu-ray and DVD, and we're combining it with Mike Snavely's video on the Grand Canyon, Puzzle on the Plateau, where Mike also explains these things, but I think more for a general audience, and then you come along and provide more of the nuts and bolts of the physics of it. It's such a powerful 1-2 punch, this set we are offering on the Grand Canyon. Just call us, 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. What a gift to give to others also. Just a really neat resource.
Bob, it's always a pleasure talking with you about these things. I feel they're very important, and I'm glad to have a platform to speak from.
All right. Well, God bless you, Brian. And so this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.